Okay, it is time. It is time for the last lesson of 2018. Hard to believe, hard to believe. And every seat that is filled tonight is a vote that will do it again next year. Yes, on this day, because I thought, oh, but if somebody doesn't show up after Thanksgiving, they forgot the class or whatever. And so if it was not a good showing today, I'd probably scratch this week next year, but good enough, we'll do it again. Okay, well, what else can I tell you? The lesson is on the board again. I can just dismiss you and we'll go home. So. Well, we have an exciting lesson. I'm going to tell you that every week, an exciting lesson. Whether you recognize it or not, I don't know. But it is an exciting lesson. Not everybody will agree with that necessarily, but anyway, anything you draw on the board has got to be exciting. So let's get right with it, because I got 73 slides you're counting to go, so we don't want to miss anything, and I want to hold you over time. So that's our opening panel. We're going to interrupt our study a little bit, the revival of studies from the time the Puritans end in 1660, a nice, easy way to remember it, 1560, 1660, that 100-year period is the time of the Puritans. Doesn't mean there weren't Puritans after that, but that's the call, the time of the Puritans, the time of the ending with the British Commonwealth, with Oliver Cromwell being the protector. That ends the period. Because after the Puritans failed, what else are you going to say? So we started there, and we've come to the beginning of the 20th century. We've looked into it a little bit with Lewis Sperry Schaefer. But before moving into it in the historical studies, we're taking a little bit of time to look at two subjects. There's a third one, but I think we have two for sure, dealing with subjects that are theological subjects around this time that play an important part in evangelicalism from the 20th century on. It starts actually in the 19th century. So the first was, last time, if I say last week, you know I meant last 2 weeks ago. The first was the work of the Holy Spirit, or more specifically, Holy Spirit in the life of the believer, more specifically, the question of sanctification. How does God set us apart as believers? That question may seem to be an easily answered one, but it is not sometimes. So last time we showed the influence of Lewis Sperry Schaefer, Dallas Seminary founder, on a wide stream of evangelicalism. We called it Keswick, Roots of Schaefer. He was Presbyterian, but he had Keswick background. He proposed two steps for full salvation, and I footnoted this because they might object to saying full salvation. But what I mean by full salvation, I mean this terminology means the victory over sin, we call it forensic justification in God's sight, and the ability to conquer sin in the daily life. Those two, I think, had to be part of salvation to be a full salvation. Because if you're just saved from the penalty of sin and not saved from the power of sin, your salvation is really short. So that's why I call full salvation means that you're not only saved from the penalty of sin, you're also saved from the power of sin. And the last one to be saved from is from the presence of sin. That's still future. So we got the three P's, two of them already are accomplished. So when I say full salvation, I mean those two aspects, the forensic as well as the daily victory over sin has been provided for in the death of Christ. Now, Lewis Sperry Schaefer promoted the idea of two kind of Christians. That's how he explained it. One was, by the name of his own book, He That Is Spiritual. And then that leaves the one that's still a Christian, but he's a carnal Christian. So we have a spiritual Christian and a carnal Christian. There you have your two steps or two kinds of Christians. Obviously, no one wants to be a carnal Christian. So for full salvation, you need to be a spiritual one. So this issue continues to confound and divide evangelicals. We've talked a little bit about that, even our church over the years. That's been an issue. The Lordship of Christ at salvation, or does it come later? The question of the charismatics, you know, is the gift of the Spirit something that is given at the time of salvation, or is there another eventual, subsequent down the road event, like tongue-speaking charismatics would think that's another sign of the Spirit? And then I call it kind of a dry charismatic. They have a perfectionism that do not expect the tongue speaking, but they do expect perfection in Christian living so you can rise to a sinless life. And the only way that ever works is you got to define your terms what sin is, because no one I have ever found can live a perfect life unless you redefine it. And then we have the various versions within that those three groups. So if you missed it, it was on, it's online. You can get it at session 10. You have to kind of look at, you know, the lessons number minus 35, but Twyla has it on at 10, which is right, because she kind of starts over with each season. So you have to kind of sometimes look at it by the date, which would be November 14. That was the first subject. The second subject is tonight's subject. The second is about the eschatology, eschatos, last words, things about the last things, of dispensationalists. And we are in a church that teaches dispensationalism. It takes the Bible literally. And so rather than come up with a new word, we're just going to use the dispensationalist as the word that describes us. Dispensationalists, by definition, are pre-trib. This is the coming, the timing of the coming of Christ. It's pre-trib, pre-millennial, so pre-pre. Okay, and it becomes a dominant theology of the fundamentalist, which will later be called evangelicals. We're going to call them fundamentalists at least up until the middle of the 20th century. So it becomes a dominant theology of the fundamentalists as they make their collective departure from the mainline denominational churches. So this starts about 1900. I would say we're going to talk about this. We're going to get into this. Arnold Gabelein, a very important person, is one of the first major figures that leaves his church, the denomination church, to form other churches. So that starts the question of how long do we stay with the sinking ship and try to keep it afloat, or do we bail out? Okay, that's a question a lot I've had to answer over the years. So this eschatology, frankly, can easily be settled by a consistent, literal reading of Scripture. This is not rocket science. This is not very difficult. Even the enemies of dispensationalism will agree that if you take it for what it says, you will come to a dispensational point of view. And I say, what else do you need to say after you say that? Well, there's another way of looking at it. And then they go on to their speculation. So taking the Bible for what it says is not the path that the latter church fathers chose, nor are the present distractors on that road either. So the futurist eschatology, that's us, came largely to be replaced by other worldly eschatology and mysticism the closer you get to the Middle Ages. So we'll start on my left-hand side and move in this way. The closer you go this way, you're going to leave premillennialism and move to this otherworldly eschatology, which I have on my chart here. I'm going to try to see if I can get this working. So this is typical Catholic doctrine, picked up by the Lutherans. It's picked up and still believed by the Covenantalists. They have never changed eschatology. It is still exactly as the Catholic Church had it from Augustine. So the kingdom is now, and it goes from here, from the Christ, to the end. It's all the kingdom. And in that, you have no distinctions. They're Jews, they're Gentiles, they're male, they're female, they're slaves, they're freed. You know, there's no distinctions because they're all one in Christ. And that's, they capitalize on that, and that's the only verse they know about, whereas the other verses say other things. So they live by that one verse, and then what you have at the end is one judgment, and you have the sheep and the goats divided. The sheep go to heaven, wherever that is, and the other ones go to hell, and then what's left on earth is just simply burned up to a crisp. I mean, literally burned up, it's gone. So that's typical amillennial theology that was adopted the further you get towards the Middle Ages. Okay, so the grip of imminentness, that means any time coming of the Lord, on believers gradually loosened after the first century, which is really quite amazing that it happened so quickly. But then again, 100 years is a long time, isn't it? I mean, few of us have lived that long, so I mean, we think 100 years is not a very long time, but in terms of lives, it's three generations generally. All right, so this is the amillennial model. I might come back to it later on, but I just want you to see that's where the church is in the middle of our chart over here. Go back to the beginning of it again. At first, the widely accepted eschatology was a Jewish eschaton, a Jewish way of looking at the Bible. Would that not make sense? The Jews had their view of the Bible, and they weren't wrong. They were wrong about the Messiah, but they weren't wrong about their history. They weren't wrong about Abraham's promise. So the Jewish eschaton, the teaching of last things, was right, and the early church accepted that because it, after all, was biblical. So at first, the widely accepted eschatology was a Jewish eschaton, that is, a period of judgment, and then a renovation of the earth was typical. And we see this typically in Isaiah chapter 24 and Isaiah 25, and there are many others that talk about the judgment and the restoration. This is a pattern the Jews were very, very familiar with. You have to just go back to the Judges and see that cycle. Judges and restoration, sin, judges, restoration, sin, judges, restoration. That's the pattern God always uses, and he was using this in the early church. So they understood it that way. So they took the Jewish idea, the Jewish pattern, and made it their own because it was the Bible they owned as well. So this Jewish hope was accepted by the early church when the Gentiles began to disdain anything Jewish. And by the time you get, after Constantine, 325, by the time you get to 341, Gentiles are excommunicated if they observed the Jewish Passover or observed Easter on the Jewish Passover. So there, this is kind of the official drawing of the line, 325. Constantine was very much against the Jews, and this finally spilled over into the church actually excommunicating anybody that had anything to do with the Jewish patterns. So they disdained anything Jewish. So when you reject the things that are real, like the days of the Passover, you have to go to something else now. So they go to a figurative assumption of the Bible, a figurative meaning of the Bible. So we have an Easter that doesn't approximate anything in the Bible. I always have thought that if the Christians go back and observe their Easter on Passover, wouldn't that be a strong apologetic to the Jews? They're sacrificing a lamb. Now, in their case, they have no lamb to sacrifice. They have no place to sacrifice. But we can say that our lamb that we worship is sacrificed on this day, and we observe that day with you. You understand that you're sacrificed as well. But they gave up on that because the Jews were not worth saving, I guess. So with Constantine, and then we have the Augustine, we have Hellenizing, the Greeking, is that a good word? Greeking the Christianity, a favorite hobby of Augustine, made the eternal age not a material one, but a spiritual one. So we'll go back to my little picture here. See, there's no millennium in that picture. You go now to the eternity. You go now to heaven or hell. That's all there's to it, all right? So that's what he picked up. That's kind of a Hellenized version of Christianity, because Hellenized version of Christianity is that they saw as the Greeks did. They said that the earth was evil and material, and it's disdainful, and it's carnal, and you don't have anything to do with that because God's got to destroy it because it's been tainted by sin, and the only thing God can do with it is throw it away. I disagree with that 200%, but that's how they looked at it. So Hellenizing Greek, a favorite hobby of Augustine, made the eternal age not a material one, but a spiritual one. It seems like we really improved, haven't we? We don't worry about the spiritual, the material world. We worry now just about the spiritual world. So this is borrowed from the Greek, a Plato idea of heaven as a perfect, unchanging place. A heaven as a distant paradise where we go and just wait, I guess, worship. And I don't mean any disrespect here, because if that's how it is, I'm sure we'll be happy there as well. But it's not how the Bible, I think, presents it. So he forsook the reality of a regenerated material earth and heaven. Augustine forsook that, and when you forsake it, what do you have left? You have nothing but a spiritual idea. So interesting guy, Alan Johnson, in the Expositors, in the book of the Revelation, has this comment about Revelation 21:1. It is remarkable that John's picture of a final millennial age to come focuses not on the Platonic idea of heaven or a distant paradise, but on the reality of a new heaven and a new earth. Now, a reality of a new heaven and a new earth, something that's tangible. Now, remember, we made this decision, or we should have made this decision back when God talked to Abraham, and he said, I'm going to give you this land. In fact, to underscore it, God said to Abraham, walk on it. Get your feet dirty in it. Walk through the mud, like kids do in mud puddles. This is your land. We're not talking about anything else but your land. Now, once you decide at that point that that's what God means, you cannot abandon that idea anywhere, ever, forever. Because otherwise God's changing his mind, you know, and that's what the covenantal tests do. So it's a very difficult decision, perhaps, at this point to say, if I'm going to say land now, it's going to stay there, I can't change it later. I cannot change it later. well, these things come out. No, but that's what the covenant will do. And we say, no, no, no. So what Abraham understood, and God made a point of it, walk on the land, look at it. As far as the eyes can see, that's your land. The promise made to Abraham to walk on it makes the earth the abode of his family, Abraham's family, the Jews, as it is the abode of was the abode of Adam and Eve. They walked on the land. So the earth is always the eternal earth, and the language is forever language. Okay. Now, the abandonment of premillennialism, that's what I have, that jogging down around 420 and a little before that. That's when Augustine did it, he speaks for everybody, you know. He is worshipped by the Catholics. He's worshipped by the Reformers. He reverts by the covenant people. So Augustine, if it's okay with Augustine, then it's okay with me, you know. I don't like that, but that's how they do it, and that's why I put it there. All right, so with Augustine, 320, he died 480. Augustine, 420, he died 430. Anyway, that's why that date is there. He wrote a City of God. Okay, now the abandonment of premillennialism came from the Southern School. Now, I put a map up there. See, allegorical is south. Allegory is south. That's Alexandria. That's Egypt. We don't think of Egypt as being a Christian place or a Jewish place for that matter, but it is. It was a highly religious place. A library was there. It was burned. Then you have Antioch, north. All right? Now, you see, if I put, see, Antioch is north, and Asia Minor is north. It's off my map. I should have got a better map. And where's John at the time of the end of the New Testament? Does anybody know? He's at Patmos, off the coast of Asia Minor. So I'm trying to show that off the map here. So John's influence was on the Antiochian church, the northern church. The northern church, I find it, this in the New Testament says something about that, that they came to Antioch and seemed like they were, seemed like more biblical. I don't know. I couldn't find the phrase exactly what I was looking for, but maybe it's historic that they say that. But the Alexandrian school was known for its more looseness, the allegorical view of Scripture. We get into Origen and Clement from Alexander. These guys are more loose. So that group was different than the literal group. So we have this split right away in the second century already. So the abandonment of premillennialism came from the Southern Alexandrian school, whereas the Northern Antiochian school was more faithful to the word. That's where they sent the missionaries out, Barnabas. They all went from Antioch. So this southern place has the reputation of the Ninth District Court. In our country, they're always over the top with their judgment. I mean, it wasn't the one you'd want to follow. So the Alexandrian school took the liberties and came to dominate. Why is it always the wrong one gets to dominate? It comes to dominate the Eastern or Western churches. So eventually the Antiochian churches, you know, lost influence. As I said, the Antiochian school won out. It was strongly influenced by Neoplatonism, again, that Greek idea. Matter is evil, spirit is good. This is the school of Origen, the Clement of Alexandria. This is the school that prevailed over the Antiochian school and was the school that Augustine embraced. Remember, he was in North Africa, so it connects across. Think of geographic connections. Also of note is that the Roman Church follows Augustine, as Luther followed Augustine. And the eschatology of the Reformation of the Covenant Churches remained Catholic with its spiritualized kingdom, rejecting an earthly kingdom, leaving one a final judgment. I gave you that picture before. That is a typical amillennial Catholic Reformed covenantal view of eschatology. We live our life, we're in the kingdom, when the Lord comes, and it's probably thousands of years away, you know, who knows. And when he comes, there's going to be judgment and the division, and it's all over, and I'm not sure what we do after that, but they say we'll be happy. So after Augustine, the church was seen as the spiritual kingdom with Satan bound, which is a stretch, Satan bound. But according to Revelation chapter 20, where Satan is bound for 1,000 years. So here now Augustine is committed. It's not the earth anymore. So, well, then there's 1,000 years. How long does it last? Well, when does it begin? You know, so we have to start monkeying around with things. So as long as he lived, he could say that. When he dies, then no one can hold him accountable, and they go on to other things. So the amillennialism changed in these medieval ages to some extent. They didn't stay put. So Satan is bound for 1,000 years, they say, with the church, the kingdom. And I say a miscalculation which continues today in the Reformed and Covenantal churches. And I say sometimes mildly in the dispensational churches that hold to an already but not yet kingdom of the church. So this whole idea of just de-Hellenizing Christianity is a really, really slow process. And I doubt that it's going to get done before the Lord comes. I could be wrong. However, the spiritualized kingdom as the millennial period was rejected by a guy in the Middle Ages, Joachim of the Four. See, he died in 1202. So he sort of took an opposition position to this spiritual kingdom. But it didn't get accepted. But it's out there in the record. Yet remained marginal until the Reformation. This idea of there is this kingdom on earth. So now I have a dotted line across there. I don't want to ever say that premillennialism ever died out completely. We don't know. You know, you didn't write about it, and you didn't write your parents about it, your wife about it, your pastor didn't write. You know, a lot of these people were under persecution. They weren't out there and open, you know, writing stuff, so they could have believed it and not talked about it. So we just don't have a lot of records in the Middle Ages. And how many people even could write, did write, so forth. So we get through the Middle Ages. We start now coming to the Enlightenment periods. We come to Wycliffe. He died in 1384. He's sometimes called the morning star of the Reformation. He removed the linchpin that led to the restoration movement of the Jews to the land. The restoration movement is down here where people start saying, aha, the Jews have a future and it's in the land, the Bible says. And the reason that Wycliffe is important here because he's the guy that translated the Bible into English. Now I'm going to read what I'm going to tell you here. I better read what I'm going to tell you here. So the Bible in English returned it to the layman. When Wycliffe did this, the Bible came into the hands of the lay people. We call them the yeoman. The average normal person could read the Bible for himself. He has no axe to grind, no commitments to make. And he said, look at there. That's it right there. You know, whatever passage he's reading. The Jews have a future. So the Puritans, you know, they wanted to purify the church. That's why that name. The Puritans in the later reign of Queen Elizabeth, she started in 1558 after Bloody Mary in England. Queenie first sought to recover the Puritans sought to recover the gospel for the Church of England, not necessarily eschatology. That was the Puritans' thing. You remember from 1560, remember 1558 when she started, so it's right after her reign, let's use that date, for 100 years, they tried to return England to the gospel. So it didn't really happen, although they wouldn't get into that part. It really didn't happen, but they tried. But they had the Bible, and it became an authority in their hands, remember, in the layman's hands. As the Bible gained authority, premillennialism began to be recovered. Remember, they read the Bible, and they see it in the Bible, and nothing was stronger than reading some of the Bible. So say from 1880, another 20 years into the Puritans' time, we have the Puritans. Then we have at the end of this period, this increase in Cotton Mather, their father and son. If you want to keep them track, increase would always be the father. Cotton is the son, named after his mother. That's kind of a funny name. The increase of the first one and the Cotton, they died within 5 years of each other in early 1700s. So these guys, increase in Cotton Mather and others, were premillennialists. Puritans. Okay? And now we're getting into Jonathan Edwards' time where we started our study. And Jonathan Edwards was not a premillennialist. He's probably somewhere hanging, waiting to figure out where this is going to come down. Yeah, kind of dangling like a spider over hellfire. Well, as I was studying for this lesson, I came across something that doesn't fit my lesson. But here's a man, Robert Matten. Is that how you'd say that? Robert Matten wrote a tract in 1641. Now, I got a little history here. 1641-42 is when the British went to civil war against Charles I. The Puritans, in a sense, against the king. The Puritans are trying to make England a Christian nation. And as long as Queen Elizabeth and her son James ran the show, there was no free press. But when the Puritans started to take over in the Commonwealth, take over, the press was liberated, so you could now write and publish things. And, of course, religious things were also banned before the you know, free press. So Robert Matten here writes right after the press becomes free. So that tells me this stuff's been bottled up for a long time. This information you write about bottled up. You don't just figure it out in one day. So he publishes it now, and it's going to be interesting what he writes. So lest we get ahead of our story, we have to do this little sidetrack. Back in the time of the Civil War in England, 1642, as the Puritans are trying to take over the government, to make it Christian, a bad Augustinian idea that had not died, we have a remarkable publication in the year of the outbreak of the war, 1642, against James I, his son, Charles I, who was executed in 49. We have the following tract, published by Robert Matten, published in two tracts. We're going to look at one of them. First was entitled Israel's Redemption or the Prophetical History of Our Savior's Kingdom on Earth. See, that's why that can't get published, because that's damaging to the Church of England, because this kingdom's in heaven, you know? They're the kingdom. In these works, Matten set out his view that the millennium promised in Revelation 20 had not yet occurred, and that it would be a future earthly event, for the 1,000-year reign is to begin at his, Christ's, next appearing, not before. An important element in Matten's millennium, is that the right spelling? Should have another N in it. Should have another N. Sometimes they have two N's, sometimes they have one N. I just got to memorize it. That shouldn't have two N's. All right. An important element of Matten's millennium. There you go. See, I need that extra N. His chronology. An important part was the restoration of the Jews to their homeland. Now remember, this has been denied them since 325. For sure, officially. So you see, well, now we're talking about 1,300 years. All of a sudden, this guy, no wonder they want this stuff published. This is revolutionary. He goes on, once the Jews were restored, a great army would rise up against them to battle in Armageddon. At the time, Christ would return and subdue the entire world. Christ would then sit as king on the throne of David and rule with his resurrected saints for 1,000 years. Does that sound familiar to you? It's amazing how familiar it is when we read the same Bible. So this 1,000 years was to follow the defeat of the beast and the false prophet. Tribulation time was to coincide with the binding of Satan for 1,000 years. Satan would then be loosed again, and after a final struggle, Gog and Magog, the second one, there would be a second resurrection of the ungodly, in which all would be judged. Then the world would end. And I don't know what he meant by this, because it didn't end like go away. It didn't get annihilated. Because when the world ended, this world was delivered by the Son to the Father, 1 Corinthians 15:24. It says that. So we know it can't end like poof, gone, because the Son's going to deliver it to the Father, so it's got to be there. So I don't know why, you know, these words, all these words need definition. You know, when it says the world comes to an end, what do you mean by that? Well, it depends on what you mean by that, you know, so you have to explain. So we have to understand he probably didn't mean, could not have meant poof, you know, evaporated. So it must come to an end in order that we would have understood it at the end of the millennium, for example. So the world would come to an end, and the Son would deliver it to the Father. And that is said in 1 Corinthians 15:24, a very important verse, where I think there is a closure to what happens during the 1,000 years. And the thing that God set out to do in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve says, fill and subdue the earth. When that happens, you can mark it. You can fill the earth and say it's full, right? You can do that. And when you subdue the earth, you can mark that and watch when it happens, and it's done. So when those things are done, I think then whatever happens is in a somewhat of a static state. I don't mean that people don't cease to be people anymore, but I think that that is the kingdom that's now given to the Father, and it goes on in perpetuity, just the way I look at it. So this pamphlet was first published in England just after the freedom of the press in 1641. Interesting is that the fact that this idea was no longer repressed but now open to the public. Restriction of the press in England also included religious writings. The people that held millennial views during Elizabeth's reign were severely persecuted and censored, even executed, and this guy named Kett was executed for these views in 1589. Okay, Puritans. Francis Kett, we just saw him. These are the ones that were premillennial. Now, you won't remember these names, but if you see him once in a while, you might pick up one or two. Francis Kett, Thomas Drakes, Thomas Brightman, Henry Finch, that's an important one. Joseph Meade, the most likely one to remember. And Roger Williams, we all know him as founding of Rhode Island. He's the premillennial guy here. He got kicked out of England, remember? And he got kicked out of the Massachusetts colony for his silly ideas about the free church. Then we have John Milton, what we know him for? Paradise Lost, right. Also premillennial. Then we have Increase and Cotton Mather. Both of them died by 1728. Now we're getting into exactly when Jonathan Edwards started serving at Northampton Church. It was the expectation of Jewish restoration that Puritan Oliver Cromwell allowed the Jews back into England after 366 years of being thrown out. 366 years the Jews were not allowed to live in England. Doesn't mean they didn't live there, you know, by one way or another. But as far as officially, they were kicked out. Now, with this new idea of restoration of the Jews, the Puritans are waking up to the idea that the Jews have a future. Well, if they have a future, maybe we should let them back into England. And then there were those that saw this as a possibility where England could help them in their establishment of a nation. All right, so we saw that Puritan Increase and Cotton Mather were premillennialists. That was 100 years before Darby. 100 years before Darby. Now, you'll understand the argument here in a minute because everybody argues that Darby came up with a silly idea late. But already 100 years ago, we had the same idea. We read Red Manton. He could have, you know, was perfect, you know, fit our theology perfectly. And that's even more longer ago. Okay, now we have taken time to recount the history of premillennialism to at least the post-Puritan times, to 1660. We have done this to show that the idea of premillennialism is not a new idea at all in the days of John Nelson Darby. The usual saw is that John Nelson Darby took the idea mid-1830s, probably 1834, from a 16-year-old sickly girl, call him a girl, who had come some kind of illusion, illumination, or vision experience, and heretic Darby, if you're looking at him from that point of view, he's a heretic. Heretic Darby, being a dishonest man, pawns off these ideas as his own on gullible people brought into the newfangled idea of an eschatological literalism. Oh, unheard of thought. Oh, no, we can't have that. But remember that since 420 AD with Augustine, allegorical reading of the Bible prevailed unchallenged, especially in eschatology, until 1850. This is 30 years before that yet. So all of a sudden we have a guy that's reading the eschatology literally. He's a heretic. And he got his silly ideas from this poor girl who only lived to be 25 years old, but she was that sick. And so she gets this moniker attached to her, Margaret MacDonald. Go to Wiki, he knows everything. There have been a couple of attempts to locate the source of Darby's concept of the rapture. No one ever believes he'd ever come up with their own idea or they'd read in the Bible for the first time. You always got to find somebody. So they're doing this. Fine, that's good. So we have a couple of attempts to locate the source of Darby's concept of the rapture. And he's going to focus on the rapture, but premillennialism gets wrapped up into this whole issue. So the belief that, now this is what he came up with, the belief that a core of Christian believers, you'll agree with this, who have died, will be raised up from the dead. Believers who are still alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds and meet the Lord in the air, First Thessalonians 4:17, in conjunction with the second coming of Christ. Now there's a seven-year period between those two. We know that. He knows that. Some of the attempts to imply that Darby's concept originated from a false source, Samuel Prideaux Tregellis, alleged that the concept was taken from one of the charismatic utterances, Margaret MacDonald, didn't have her name here, in the Edward Irving Church, 1840-something. Since Tregellis regarded the utterance as pretending to be from God, the implication is that Darby's rapture is from a demonic source. However, they're still in Wiki here. However, scholars think there are major obstacles that render these accusations untenable. It is clear that Darby regarded the 1830 charismatic manifestations as demonic, not from God. Darby would not have borrowed an idea from a source that he clearly thought was demonic, to make sense to us. Also, Darby had already written out his pre-tribulational rapture views in January 1827, you know, 3 to 6 years before the 1680 or 1640, whatever the date was, event, and any McDonnell utterance. So he was way ahead of her and wrote it down, so it couldn't have got it from her. So when McDonald's utterance is, no, we're done yet. We're not done yet. When McDonald's utterance is read closely, her statements appear to represent a post-tribulational scenario, which says, being the fiery trial, which is to try us, it's the tribulation, and for purging and purifying of the real members of the body of Jesus. That sounds post-trib. Christians lived through the tribulation to be purified. It's not pre-trib. Darby was pre-trib. Wouldn't go through this fire experience. Now get this. Confusion on this point was enhanced because while McDonald's vision, at first published in 1840, describes a post-tribulational view of the rapture, a version published in 1861 lacked these two passages that appear to present a post-tribulational view. Talk about managing the news or fake news. There's a great example. Maybe it's the beginning of it. Who knows? So missing in the quote of 1861 is, this is the fiery trial which is to try us, the tribulation. It'll be for the purging and purifying of the real members of the body of Christ, the church. So the church goes through the tribulation. They took that out. But Darby got it from him. Well, if Darby got it from him, why did he take that part out? So the trial of the church is from the Antichrist. It is by being filled with the Spirit that we shall be kept. The idea here, post-trib, you're going to go through the tribulation. Mark McDonald's vision supported that. We know that she got that from the devil. Oh, excuse me. Because we don't think it's right. Okay, for these and other reasons, dispensational scholars consider McPherson's alleged connection to dispensationalism as untenable. But even Wikipedia cannot knock down the false charges. Surprising is the fact that those who claim they have a historic faith are embarrassed to learn that preterism, which is the basis of all millennial attacks, is a later arrived theology. We do not claim historic authority. That's not what our source is. But since they bring up history, we'll argue with them. Premillennialism has the edge besides being thoroughly biblical, a more important point. It'd rather be biblical than historical, correct. But if they want to argue, we'll argue history. So we've covered the arguments, say, until 2000, the fake reporting on Mark McDaniel's vision and the demonic effort on and his demonic effect on Darby kept on being repeated. So we have a deadlock in essence. No matter how forceful the argument, McDonald doesn't go away. As a tainted source is found in much of the literature attacking dispensationalism in 2014, a surprise, we come to William Watson. William C. Watson, look at that face. The Colorado Christian University guy in Dallas, Texas, the pre-trib conference. First time I ever saw him. I don't know if I met him or not, but he was there. Remember, the argument used against dispensationalists is an historical one. And I say it's not a good one for two reasons. One thing, the history is against them. The second thing, it's not biblical. The second one's more important than the first one. So here William Watson has done a great service to shut the mouths of critics claiming that dispensationalism is a late and a demonic arrival. There's direct evidence that historic record is on the side of the premillennialists, but no one has ever done the work because why bother when a stronger case can be made from the biblical text? I mean, that is part of the reason. But here, William Watson has done a great service, and here is his story. At the Pre-Trib Conference in 2014, William Watson presented a paper using material for a book for which he had found no publisher. In the conference, a new publishing company was there, and I better read it. But a new publishing company was at the conference, picked up the task. Now, some of you know Wayne House's writing. He's a real good guy. Some of the views that I have on 2 Thessalonians he had a long time ago, and I found one guy that agreed with me. And so, anyway, the rapture I mean, in 2 Thessalonians 2:2, I think it is, the apostasy there is the rapture. That's the issue. Wayne House agrees with that. So Wayne House was at the conference, an author and now also a publisher called Lampion Press, does a lot of Mike Vlock's work, publishes his stuff. So we have the book. That was the part of the paper it presented, and I have my own personal copy of it, and Twilight has 3 down there, and it's not for children, and I was going to say women or children, that wouldn't be right, but not women's fine, but children would be a little tough. And you got to be dedicated to read the stuff, and I'll explain why. So here's William Watson. First, a little bit of cholera Christian where he is, and I said that he is a dispensationalist in his school of thieves. He's the only dispensationalist teacher in the school. Oh, where do I want to go here? All right, here we go. So he says, and this is in the fly of his book, my primary motivation for beginning the research that culminated in this book stemmed from an exchange with a colleague at Colorado Christian University, Dr. Johan Kim, professor of New Testament studies. Dr. Kim and I debated the ideas of dispensationalism and Christian Zionism, and they go together, before a large audience in the spring of 2007. When he declared that the ideas were developed in 150 years ago in the mind of John Nelson Darby, and probably might have thrown in there Margaret MacDonald as well. Now he says, got a little quotes in front of us, it'll be him, having spent decades digging through archives and databases of pre-Victorian is before 1837, Queen Victoria, where we get our Victorian ideas from, a straight-laced culture. The dates from pre-Victorian, pre-1837, remember Darby wrote 1827, so from 1837 and before, if you look in literature, before that time, before Darby. So this literature was published in conjunction, he was studying this in conjunction with other studies, and he runs across this. I've regularly encountered apocalyptic tribulation literature or material that seemed similar to Darby's, and I decided after that debate to dedicate my life, actually, my time to studying them. And I'm going to skip the next part because he got ridiculed for doing this because you lose your mind doing this. So I'm going to skip all this because of the time. All right. So the study of eschatology and Bible prophecy has always attracted more than its fair share of scoffers. That's just what I went through. There's a bunch of people that really made fun of him for doing this. Now, the method I followed in this work was to spend 4 years studying only 4 years. It's a big issue, folks. 4 years studying primary sources before reading historians and theologians. This was made possible by using search engines of the early English books online. And I think he said that to get a subscription to that service, it cost you $5,000 a year. So it has to be in conjunction usually with some library that has it. So you want to go home and look these books up, you can't do it unless you got the money. And if you have the money, you don't want to spend it on that anyway. So he's going back to original sources, and this ability to go back online and look into these books is incredibly helpful now. He says, only later did I check my conclusions with that of the other writers, historians, and theologians. So he's doing original work by himself. He goes on with the book. He apologized to the reader for quoting at length, and there are some stuff that are really, really hard to read. And he'll say that I didn't change any of the spelling of it, so you've got to read Old English. You know, they have Y's instead of I's, and, you know, the syntax is way different. So you really got to, you know, be wanting to do this. So my apologies to readers for quoting at length so that many passages from the primary sources. My intent is to satisfy any speculation that the passages have been taken out of context or my own interpretation have been imposed upon the sources. So this is not a popular work for children, I said, expressing eschatological speculation, but academic endeavor and attempt to discover what was believed centuries ago. I was trying to do something up here. Pre-tribulationalism, well, from here to here, is I wanted to show it. There was a gap. Now we had that Matt and, you know, show fill up in the gap, but without him or people like him, there just was nothing. Did you go back and show what those people believed until Watson? So he says, my conclusion is that the ideas of filial Semitism, which I love the Jews, premillennialism, and even pre-tribulationalism were more prevalent before the 19th century than many have supposed. Further, many of those revered by contemporary preterists, such as Westminster Assembly divines, Anglican bishops, and renowned Puritans on both sides of the Atlantic, were actually premillennialists, not preterists. While preterists claim that the premillennialism is new, it is actually preterism that was considered an innovation in the early 18th century. Preterism means that everything's already happened. There's no prophecy to be fulfilled. Okay, so just so you know. So I use more than 350 sources. I have used more than 350 primary sources, most of which have not been read, much less cited for centuries. He talked about, he's a humorous guy. He said, I got in there, and some of this was online, but you know, he goes actually in the library, and I blew the dust off these books. These had not been open for 200 years. Can you imagine the feeling of that? If you're a guy like him. Now, this was due largely to the fact that the writings are either unfamiliar or previously inaccessible by many researchers. I mean, without the internet, you'd have to go to London to sit in libraries for a whole summer to do this. So he talks about these search engines that he used. All right. So my hope is that other scholars will build on my research, refining and collecting any oversights, blah, 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 blah. So, Watson, it is my intention to show that the ideas of dispensationalism, Christian Zionism, known at the time of the Restoration, as known as Restorationism, existed in the 17th and the 18th centuries, so 16th and 1700s, long before Nelson Darby, who is considered the father of modern dispensationalism, and Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, articulated them. The ideas espoused by Darby were present in early British theology dating back to the English Puritanism, long before Darby set them within a framework that consequently arose as a system in the 1800s. That's his point. And that's what was missing. So one American scholar has insisted that the traditional criterion of classifying millennialism pre-post is virtually meaningless for the emerging systems prior to 1800. You can't use those words for that time. This Gibbon, a current leading author, a scholar of apocalypses, warns that modern categories of pre, post, and should not be retrospectively projected into older material. However, Watson says that's exactly what I'm intending to do, because you can use those terms then. Okay, you know what future premillennialism is. I should really go for this. We'll just skip it. You know what it is. We've been through it. It's what we believe. So before 1948, many Jews and even some Christians expected a return to the promised land that they believed that God had given to the Jews as recorded in the biblical text. My grandfather died in 1946. He believed that. He didn't see it, but he believed it. The only way I know that, my mom told me, because I was 8 when he died. Since 1848, I was 10. No, 8, 9. I was 9. Thank you. Since 1948, these same Jews and Christians have been avid supporters of modern state of Israel. This is me. Is this a fulfillment of prophecy? Now, the way I like to answer this, is this a fulfillment of prophecy? I think the best way to answer this is with an emphatic yes, until proven otherwise. Okay? That's how prophecy always works. Hitler, as the Antichrist in World War II, could not be the Antichrist because he should be falsified very quick because he wasn't Roman. See, if there's something wrong with the picture, it's wrong. All right, so that's what we do with Israel back in the land. Is it's true unless we can falsify it. It can't be true because of this thing here. All right, so we have this. Hitler could easily be falsified. Here, Israel in the land cannot be falsified. And I say yet. Maybe something will come along where you can falsify it, then you've got to give up on it. But until it comes along, you've got to say it is fulfilled until. Therefore, the Ezekiel passages of 38 and 39 remains a fulfillment until something, if anything, ever arises to falsify it. The pattern Ezekiel 37-39 perfectly matches the dry bone stages. And remember, we're still in rejection stages. They're not fully accepted because all are not yet believers. But that's what it says. They will be partially, you know, awakened. Not even partially awakened. They're called dead bones. All right. I'm saying that about the Zionism stuff. We have another evidence for this is that Isaiah 11:11, easy to remember, Isaiah 11:11, it will happen on the day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand, the remnant of his people. Well, when was the first time? not Egypt, Babylon. When they came out of Babylon, the remnant was recovered. This, and that was from one nation. It says one nation. Now this says it will come from nations, from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, Cush, Eman, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea, which I understand that's coastlands, that means anything beyond, I would say, the Euro-Asian continents. In other words, they come from everywhere. I would say, so for the first time out of Babylon, a single nation, the second time of the nations of the world, a sample, a list of the nations are given here, and it's a startling fulfillment in 1948, unless something disqualifies it. So we're safe in saying until. Okay. Now, millennialism, also the kingdom, and its idea of the coming of a Messiah to rescue Israel from operation was a common notion at the time of Jesus. Remember, it was the Jewish eschaton. The Jews expected judgment in the kingdom that was in the Old Testament. So during the time of Jesus, he taught it. All right. He talked about the tribulation, Matthew 24. So millennialism and its idea of the coming Messiah to rescue Israel from oppression was a common notion at the time of Jesus, evidenced by the wealth of apocalyptic texts found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is 200 BC to about the time of Christ. They all expected something to happen. In fact, I think some of them believe that's why the Dead Sea Scrolls were even buried, because they thought this apocalypse was coming and they had to preserve the text. As a supposition, we don't know that, but why would they do this? Proponents of and distractors of Christianity acknowledge the early Christians expected an impending apocalypse. Future eschatology came largely to be replaced by otherworldly eschatology. We had that earlier in mysticism. The closer we get to the Middle Ages. Sound like a repeat. Now, these are early guys. When Justin Martyr asked in 150 AD whether he believed that Jerusalem would have been destroyed, should be rebuilt. In fact, it was only 25 years after it was destroyed. It was destroyed in 135 by Hadrian. Whether he expected it to be rebuilt and whether he expected his people to be gathered together and made joyful with Christ and the patriarchs, he responded, I and many others are of this opinion. Now, we're talking about earthly Jerusalem here. Similarly, around AD 170, Irenaeus claimed to have an indispensable part of orthodoxy to believe that these things shall indeed come to pass on this earth. In about 180, Tertullian claimed that he saw the heavenly Jerusalem about to descend to earth in anticipation for the kingdom, and that Christians should expect Christ to appear in Jerusalem. Similarly, others. With the exception of the metaphorical Alexandrian school, which you talked about earlier, was strongly influenced by Neoplatonism. They didn't believe in that. They went to a spiritual kingdom. It was not until the Roman Empire converted to Christianity in the 4th century that there was a move away from a belief in the impending apocalypse. In part, this was because while one looks for a Messiah when oppressed, when Christianity became widespread, there was perceived to be no need of an imminent returning Messiah. We can take care of it ourselves. That's why the Lord likes to keep us under pressure. By the 4th century, Eusebius, not a friend of dispensationalists or premillennialists, Eusebius of Caesarea and Jerome, Catholic, translated the Bible into Latin, had begun to attack the idea of future millennialism, preferring to believe that the growing power of Christianity would bring in the present millennium. Augustine of Hippo, North Africa, followed suit, although he admitted he had once held a futurist millennial views, like many others. He later rejected a future 1,000 years, believed they were currently in the millennium. Although it's beyond the scope of this work, Watson says, to recount the entire history of prophetic interpretation during Christianity's first 16 centuries, it is notable that there were majority and minority interpretations. This was not simply one view prophecy, even though one view of millennialism prevailed during many of these centuries. I just got to give you some examples of this love of Israel. Remember, this is stuff that Watson is figuring out, finding out, that no one knew about. Well, no one. Wasn't acknowledged. Okay, we have one example of a philo-Semitism, loves Jews. One of the best examples of philo-Semitism developing among the Puritans is a treatise published in 1654, 4 years before the end of the Commonwealth, by an author using the initials JJ, who called himself Philo-Judas, the Judaeus, or the lover of Jews. To the charges that God abandoned the Jews, he insisted, is what he writes. We do never find, Christian reader, that the Lord did ever cast away his people. Does that not remind you of a Bible in Roman, a verse in Romans? When Titus, the Roman general, carried them away captive, scattered them to this very day throughout the four corners of the earth, remember 1654, and thus cast off shall be until the fullness of Gentile come in. But if Israel's restoration cannot be far off, many scoffers there now are saying, when will the Jews be called? And where's the promise of his coming? I didn't read that very well, but he's just saying that people are saying, well, when is it going to happen? You know, like about the Lord's coming. They, that is the scoffers, likewise shall have their reward for being wrong. This should make all men believers when the Hebrews shall by providence come into the nations. You know, when they go back to the land, that should, wow, God's right. I mean, the Bible's right. Did that happen in 48? You think it should have. So necessary is it that Israel should be called before the Lord's coming to judge the world? Jerusalem must be trodden down by the Gentiles. He's following exactly what we call premillennialism. So according to human judgment, Israel is past recovery, they say. God's forgotten them. But according to the supernatural promise of God, they were never so near to their restoration as now. Remember 1654, he thought the restoration was near. And when the Lord sees that there's no man to help, his own arm will raise and put new life into these dead and dry bones. Where'd you get that from? Ezekiel 38. In the meantime, I desire thee to remember desolate Zion in all thy prayers to God. So he then bemoans, this is really interesting, he bemoans the Jerusalem, the chief residence of a Turkish infidel. Remember, this is during the Turkish Empire. Called languishing Zion, and the bywords of nations, and to the heartbreak of the Israelites, hath for its religion erected in it the abomination of desolation spoken of Daniel the prophet, which is the Dome of the Rock. You know, he's off on that one a little bit, but he gets the idea. He seemed to suggest that the Muslim Dome of the Rock was this abomination, and seeing how God overturned the monarchy in 1649, killed the king. I don't like that, but since God turned over the monarch in England, he concluded God could also overrule the Turkish in Jerusalem. And he did it in 1918. He's got the dates wrong. And to establish a Jewish state. They did that in 1948. Now, this guy, 1654, did not know about World War I, did not know about World War II, and all the things that transpired. But he was on target what's going to happen. Right on target. He got rid of the Turks without a hardy, you know, took World War I. So we have in this latter age seen so many of the great examples of the almighty power of God, he says, to change our government. He's talking about England. He changed the government in England, just like that. Yet there are some men amongst us that, notwithstanding the testimony of the Holy Word, do believe that the present sad state of Judah will never change for the better, and that our faith concerning the return or supposed lost Israel is grounded upon an uncertain and sandy foundation, he says. Which is, he disagrees with that. So the filio-Judaeus denied the preterist interpretations, he says, for to say that which was promised concerning Israel has already happened is false. That's preterism. St. Paul said it does not come until the fullness of the Gentiles come in. A couple more here, and we're just going to quit. Okay, now the Turkish obstacle, to me that's really, really interesting because we see what he said about it, and we know what happened. What a wonderful place to be. So he said, a major burial, this is JJ here, the major burial to the return of the Jews to the empire was the Ottoman Empire. A common theme in a, this is Watson writing, I'm sorry, about JJ. A major barrier to the return of the Jews to Jerusalem was the Ottoman Empire. A common theme in the apocalyptic works of the 17th century was the expectation of the collapse of the formidable Turkish Empire, the return of the Jews to Jerusalem, and the conversion of the Jews to Christianity. Well, the Ottomans ended the Byzantine Empire in 1453. The conquest by Mahmed, the Conqueror, during 16th and 17th centuries, at the height of the power of Zin of Suleiman, who built the walls of Jerusalem, the Ottoman Empire was a multinational, multilingual empire. Huge. And that's in the time of this, where this guy writes. Beginning of the 17th century, empire contained 32 provinces and numerous vassal states. So William Sherwood cited Meade, Joseph Meade, remember him earlier, was one of the Puritans, expected at any time, back 1648, well, he would have been a little bit later, early 1600s, expected any time the ruin of the Turk, because the Turk is holding the land in his possession where the material temple God formerly stood. He knew that God was going to remove the Turk sometimes. So keeping out the Jews, which shall be converted and did possess it. So anyway, the Dome of the Rock has been standing there since the 7th centuries. Okay. Although his anti-Semitism dominated the medieval period and was perpetuated by the early reformers, by the late 16th century, filial Semitism began to reemerge. It had reached its height during the Commonwealth period due to the efforts of Manasseh ben Israel, a Jewish guy promoting Judaism in England, and his English supporters, culminating in the fact that Jews were being allowed back into the land that had been vacated by the Jews for over 300 years. Then we have the Balfour in 1917, we have the British Mandate in 1918. I should say at the bottom, it says, and even some of the advocated active role of England in aiding the Jews to return to the land. So England has been around this for a long time. Okay, let's see, that's that one. Okay, I'm going to get my ending here. So when Darby reveals his conclusion based on the Bible alone, he said, not on someone's commentary, by his own testimony, we have a reassurance that the Bible text will say the same thing to all peoples across cultures and centuries. If you want a connection to the past for premillennialism, that is available too, as we saw. These ideas do connect nicely. And we will never know exactly what Darby had in his mind when he went to the scripture, because he had all this framework, the background too, which he didn't know, we say we didn't have. So how much that influenced him, we don't really know. But what he wrote, he says, is his own work. So what Darby did was to go back to the promises and build out to the fulfillment, keeping the literal readings as control over speculation. My example this morning I used with the men says I put up Christmas decorations. And if ever you guys have Christmas lights, ladies, put up lights, they always go in the box and they come out of the box like a tangled mess, right? So what do you do when you have a tangled roll of wire? What's the first thing you do? I know some say throw it in the trash. No. What do you do? First thing you do to untangle it, find an end. That's what Darby did. He went to find the end and then work in. If you start in the middle and try to solve it, this is true for any eschatological problem. That's why I said before, when you start the eschatological problem with what we talk about in Revelation or here, you got to start the beginning. What's the beginning of this? Abraham's promise that God made to Abraham. Was it the earth or was it not? That's the beginning of the string. If you say it's going to be the earth forever, then you're going to have to stick with that and live with it. If you say, well, it's earth for a while and then it's going to change, well, you got to live with that. Then you live with allegory. So in one sense, it's easy because all you got to do is go back to the beginning and start there and stick with it. Stick with your guns. So I don't know how this is going to work out. It doesn't matter. Stick with it and then just make it work because the Bible makes it work. So what Darby did was to find that plug at the beginning of the cord. I know there's two ends to the cord, but we're going to assume they're going to plug in the right end because it always works better to plug it in and find out all the lights work rather than do all the untangling, find out you plug it in, they don't work. Got it? So if they're not going to work, you all know that before you start. All right. So what Darby does was go back to the promises and build out to the fulfillment, keeping the literal readings as control over speculation. I got to stay literal. The simple process makes the Bible an open book to all who would venture to spend time to get it, to get to know it or to understand it literally. Once the shackles of allegory are broken, the quest for learning or knowing brought its dispensational premillennialism to the Bible conference movement in 1875. That's how it got there, because they started reading the Bible for what it said. And from there, it was dispersed far and wide. With many trained in this new way of dealing with the Bible, I say new ways in quotes because it's not a new way. It's been rediscovered. With many trained in this new way of dealing with the literal Bible, the first half of the 20th century will be the golden days of the evangelicals. And that is what we're going to look at next January. And with that, I wish you a Merry Christmas.